Hey, everybody, here's a teaser from today's episode.
I really believe we are setting our children up for failure by being so arrogant that we think we can throw away 90% of the solar spectrum and there not be a consequence.
Welcome to the Mindful Medicina podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jeanette Daniels. I'm a naturopathic medical doctor on a mission to inspire a renewed confidence in the intelligence of the human body. And joining the conversation today is my friend and colleague, Janelle Hartman, lymphatic and colon hydrotherapist, esteemed yoga teacher of teachers, and the co-producer of this show.
Today we have Scott Zimmerman, who is an expert optics engineer, photobiology expert, and research scientist who is raising awareness of the role of infrared light in human health. Over the past few years, Scott has been focused on quantifying the health effects of natural sunlight. His efforts led to the development of the NERA product line with its patent-pending design that reintroduces near-infrared into our homes and offices. This research, co-authored with Professor Russell Reiter, was recently published in Melatonin Research, a peer-reviewed medical journal, and featured in LED Professional. In response to the pandemic, Scott extended this work toward developing novel lighting and HVAC systems that suppress disease spread. He authored a peer-reviewed paper on this topic that was published in the Journal of Infectious Disease and Epidemiology. Scott notes that incandescent bulbs of the past had health benefits due to the near-infrared spectrum they generated, but they used about 6 times the energy of current LEDs. With about 20% of the world's energy used for lighting, something needed to change. As the lighting industry developed fluorescents, compact fluorescents, and LEDs to deliver much-needed energy efficiency, it focused on lighting spaces instead of light's interaction with the human body. At the time, the positive health benefits of near-infrared energy were largely unknown. The near-infrared spectrum that is present in natural sunlight was not included in these energy-efficient bulbs. They only included the visible light spectrum. Scott made it his mission to create the first LED light bulb that would mimic natural sunlight by adding the invisible spectrum of near-infrared energy that the body requires. In today's episode, we will illuminate your understanding on why the type of lighting you have in your house matters, why near-infrared is pivotal to health, and what's the deal with blue light blocking, and what is this red light therapy craze all about? Get ready for us to light up your lives. I'm sure most of you are hearing the craze over blue blocking glasses and red devices. I'm a big proponent of blocking non-native blue light myself and encouraging all my patients to do the same. While sales around blocking blue light and adding some red light into the environment are a step in the right direction for managing toxic light environments, it's not enough. Most people don't know anything about lighting and its extraordinary impact on health. Ancient civilizations relied upon and even worshipped the sun for their very existence. On the contrary, since electricity came onto the scene, the sun has been replaced by light bulbs, and instead of being worshipped, it's feared. With each generation of children, there is less and less time spent in natural light, and more time spent on toxic non-native light devices, while all the while sitting under fluorescent or LED flickering blue lights. A study done by the Nature of Americans National Report in 2017 found that more than half of adults reported spending 5 hours or less outside each week, and parents of children 8 to 12 years old said that their children spend three times as many hours with computers and televisions each week as opposed to playing outside. So my pressing question today is, what happens to human health when we move from under the sun, outside in the light, to being indoors? We moved from fire to incandescent light bulbs and to finally toxic, flickering blue light bulbs of all sorts. I believe the sun is the light bulb of our lives. The sun is the light bulb we are missing. Our hospitals, offices, homes, and schools are sickly places to be in large part because we are missing the near-infrared spectrum, which accounts for 90% of the sun's light waves. Let's not forget the missing UVA and UVB. All of these environments could be remedied simply by opening a window. We have become domesticated, living in modern-day lit caves, and sold on the value of so-called energy-saving visible light bulbs at the expense of our health. The type of light we consume is more important than the food we eat, simply because we consume more energy from light than the macronutrients that we put into our mouths. We are so excited to go into the matter of light with all of you today and want to welcome our guest, Scott Zimmerman, who will bring light to the topic of the non-visible light spectrum and why near-infrared light exposure matters to our health and what to do to improve our lighting environment. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you.
Scott.
I liked your intro.
Thank you.
That was a good one.
Uh-huh. Thank you, guys. All right, that's the end of the conversation. Okay, Scott, tell us a little bit about...
Well, I don't have anything left to say. You said it all.
No, like we're just done. let's go get some lunch.
Let's go get some light.
Yeah, let's go eat some light. Can you tell us a little bit about your background? And you're an optical engineer, so can you give us a little background onto what brought you into all of this studying light as medicine?
I started out that I've been working in the area of displays and lighting for 40 years. I have 85 issued patents in the area. And I was working, coming up with some new products, and I started looking around at what was going on in this particular photobiomodulation groups. And it kind of struck me as kind of strange. I went up and interviewed Hamlin and talked to some others. I was looking at what kind of lighting I could actually do that would be healthier. And what I noticed was that a number of the studies that had been done on PBM was exposing the body to near-infrared at basically the levels that you used to get when you were sitting underneath a well-lit incandescent house, and definitely a room or your office. But that what's been happening is that there people aren't aware, but we've gone through the largest reduction in near-infrared in the human history by eliminating it, not just from our lighting, but from our displays. Even our windows are, the low-E glass windows are blocking near-infrared from coming in. And so, you know, I was looking around trying to figure out what could be done. And so we started developing some lighting sources that are the closest match you can get to sunlight that's available now and are still energy efficient. So that was kind of my motivation. It's kind of odd, but this used to be the norm that we would use sunlight, and it still is in some countries, to enhance the body's ability to treat a number of different things. But unfortunately, with the antibiotics and all that that came into the scene, there was actually a concerted effort to stop that kind of work and focus more on drugs and other approaches to dealing. And I'm not against big pharma in that regard. They're trying to do their best, but they are ignoring what I believe is a very potent part of what the body does to keep us healthy every day. You know, mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. The body harvests light. We also make light inside of the mitochondria. And so
as a result of that, light becomes a very important part of our diet. With my patients, I go into their light as a part of their diet conversation, and I let them know that I think that that takes precedence over any of the macronutrients, in part because a lot of them will be coming in for weight issues, and we know that blue light toxicity specifically, as it's unopposed by red light or near-infrared light, causes a negative impact on the leptin-melanocortin pathway. So they could be having the most pristine diet and not able to lose weight, and then you find out they're on their laptop for 8+ hours a day making sugar and cortisol, and we'll go into cortisol a little bit later. But the light is very critical in that, like I said, the body harvests it. We consume it and we make it. We are what we eat. Yeah. And we are what we admit, right? So
yeah. Well, I think one of the things that to me was really frustrating is that there is such a limited understanding about, I'm an optics guy, and understanding, you know, you think after all these years, we'd know how light penetrates into the body, where it goes, what's it doing. But when you really get down to it, we will talk about everything but light. You know, when they talk about diet and exercise, those, and you know, all those things are discussed, you know, anxiety. But for some reason, light is, I think, because people think they know what it is when they really don't. And you, as you said in your intro, you know, the majority of energy that the body absorbs is from sunlight. And the majority of that sunlight is in the near infrared, which we are essentially eliminated from a lot of, from especially certain groups. I mean, we've done a lot of work looking at the different groups based on gender, based on skin type, based on age. And what you find is that the body is doing some amazing things to collect and localize, especially in the near infrared, in some of our most sensitive tissues like the fetus, the gray matter. And it was just really surprising that there wasn't that much out there in the lit about the effect of how light propagates in the body and what it's doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're over-focusing now on the dependency on pharmaceutical drugs and just whatever the food gurus are putting out there these days, instead of looking at the foundation, or, you know, your first domino is light. I mean, you don't have food without light, and you don't have anything without light. So I agree with you. Light is kind of off people's radar when it comes to the field of medicine in general. And I'm pushing to bring that awareness to my patients for sure. And when they come into my office, I have an incandescent light bulb on, and everyone always talks about how it's super hard to see in there, but so we'll get into talking about what you made. But I just want to dive right into this conversation on the many light frequencies to give our listeners the basic foundation of all of these light frequencies and wavelengths. And I would say that one could argue that we're legally blind, since 90% of the light spectrum is non-visible light, which is the piece that's missing from our lives. As you noted, nobody's going outside anymore. So could you briefly go into the varying wavelengths of light, and maybe differentiating the non-visible versus visible?
Okay. Well, I mean, what actually makes it to the ground is between 250 nanometers, which is UV, and runs all the way down to 3,000 to 4,000, greater than 4,000 nanometers. So there's this huge area, and of that, about 10% of that is what we can see with our eye. The UV, as you've gone into discussed earlier, has a lot of effects, and has gotten a lot of attention because of vitamin D and all that. Mm-hmm. But the vast majority of the energy and photons that are actually getting into the body are actually in the, what we call the deep red and the near infrared, which runs from about 600 nanometers down to 1,200 to 2,000 nanometers, depending on what you're looking at. And those wavelengths have a unique unique situation in that in the UV and in most of the visible, most of the energy is localized in the outer part of the skin. It's absorbed fairly quickly. And so people talk about milliwatts per centimeter squared of energy or of power into the body. But in the near infrared, it's a much different situation. And I don't know if you've ever seen some of Bob Fosbury's pictures where he takes some near infrared sources, puts his hand on it and does photography. And you see that the entire hand lights up. Mm-hmm. You can see basically the same thing when you look at, if you take your thumb and put it over your cell phone in a dark room, you'll see that your thumb turns this red color and glows all over the place. And that's what we've been kind of focused in, is trying to understand how light actually moves. And unfortunately, from an optical standpoint, there's been a lot of misinformation in the literature, in that they don't understand. They're trying to argue that the near infrared only penetrates a millimeter or whatever. And it's because they don't understand how to actually measure the skin. And if I can take a quick second, this is a pet peeve for me. If you take an ice cube and you get a clear ice cube and you shine a laser through it to a detector on the other side, you get basically, other than the Fresnel losses, you get the 100% transmission. If I take an ice cube or a snowball and form it into the same thing and do exactly the same thing, you'll see that all the light is, the entire snowball lights up, and the amount that's transmitted to the detector drops off dramatically. And so what it's called a diffuse volume, scattering volume is what the skin is. And in order to understand it, you have to do, it's one of the hardest measurements to do in optics, but it's what actually makes the near infrared so important, because what it does is it allows it to engage with basically all your mitochondria. And you know, that's where you're getting this huge amplification effect, because the light is going and bouncing around inside your body until it finds some mitochondria or some other weak absorber. And it's doing that in depths of inches, not just millimeters. And I think that's one of the things that people need to understand, is that, you know, you are a solar collector, especially in the near infrared. And it goes deep into the body, and it's engaging with trillions and trillions of mitochondria that people didn't really understand was going on. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what's fascinating is that you can actually ascertain the near infrared wearing clothes. It'll just go right through it. Does near infrared, is it able to penetrate triple pane windows?
The problem is not the glass is actually a pretty good medium to transmit. And in the old days when I grew up, you know, it was just glass. Well, unfortunately, what's going on now, to save energy, you have low E glass, which they actually put a coating on the glass and actually reflect the near infrared out of prevent the near infrared from coming in to the building. So we are actually making, as you said, our modern caves are black, or they're dark if we were to look in the near infrared. And that is one of the bigger, and it's kind of interesting, because everybody talks about biophilic and putting plants inside with their offices, and isn't that great? But if your windows are reflecting the near infrared out, then there's nothing to reflect on plants. If you look at near infrared photography, you can see that what happens to our surroundings. And to really understand how much power and energy is going into the body, you have to take in not only account the sun direct, the light that's coming from direct, which represents a fairly small component, but with the majority of what we're actually exposed to is reflecting off the ground, the dirt, the leaves of the trees, the grass. That is, if you look at the photography, you'll see that they all look like they got snow on them in the near infrared. It's because they're very strong reflectors. And so the body is adapted under the assumption that it's got all this near infrared being pumped into it from all directions. And as I said, walking vertically, you're like a little solar absorber in the near infrared. You're picking it up from all directions, and you get about a 3 to 4x enhancement in the ratio of near infrared to visible by looking at the light that's, if you're walking in the forest versus sitting in front of, inside of, and in, just getting light directly.
Yeah, I mean, even rocks are emitting the near infrared. Everything outside is, we're just drenched in this gorgeous near infrared light when we're outside. And so this is in part a part of the health devastation, I think, with these Neolithic diseases, is that we have stepped away from this near infrared.
Well, there's just been a general opinion, I think, that, well, it's just heat. And unfortunately, and I wish I could make everybody understand this, it's no more heat than visible light is. It's no more heat than UV is. It just, where it gets distributed to and how it behaves, you know, yes, is there a difference between how a photon of UV affects a molecular bond? Absolutely. But there's, to say that the near infrared isn't changing the characteristics of the biology and the process is just wrong. And it's unfortunate that, you know, our modern hospitals, it used to be, I don't know if you've ever been to Ellis Island, but one of the hospital there at Ellis Island was one of the last pavilion hospitals that they built. And in that hospital, everything, the windows were always open. There was radiant floor heating. They did the surgeries up on conservatories under clear glass. And they were treating every disease basically known to man from people coming in to the country. And, you know, it is amazing that what happened was, is that once they started having antibiotics, then all of a sudden hospitals got closed down. There's no near infrared coming in. My granddaughter, I tried to open the window at the hospital one time, and it was like, you can't open the windows. You can't. Yeah, yeah. You can't let in any fresh air. You can't let in any sunshine. And it's unfortunate, but I believe that we've basically set up in an artificial environment that is, it's not that what we're being exposed to, it's what we're not being exposed to that is what's really important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as I noted, that schools, and as you said, hospitals, all of these places, our work environments. Now that this is on my radar, that the lighting in my life is probably the most important thing besides, I would say, my mind and my soul and my thoughts, right? Because I believe that also is right up there.
Well, you know, what's crazy, I mean, I'm an optics guy. And, you know, when all of a sudden, to my knowledge, no one had ever bothered to look at how the light propagates in the brain, you know, and when you do, you start seeing this amazing effect where the skin and the skull basically filter out the violets and the UVs and the higher energy photons, but the near infrared passes through, and you can see that simply by go tell a ghost story and stick a flashlight up your nose, and you'll basically see the red edge that extends way out into the near infrared. But then you find that the cerebral spinal fluid has a peak transmission in the near infrared. Why? Well, it also has very low scatter, so it acts like a little light guide and pulls that near infrared down into the fissures of the brain, and the gray matter is ideally positioned to take advantage of absorb of that near infrared. And like I say, you look at all the different parts of the body and how it goes to extreme lengths to increase the ratio of near infrared to visible on our most sensitive tissues. You know, the majority of the photons that actually make it to the retina don't actually come through the pupil. They actually come through the sclera and the eyelid. And you can kind of even see that by, if you walk outside and close your eyes and put your face up towards the sun, you'll see this kind of orange glow. And that's the red edge. And they're in plants, that's where they start reflecting. In animals, that's where they start absorbing. So it's a amazing symbiotic relationship that has developed, you know, between plants and animals that You know, it's taking advantage of what it needs, and we're taking advantage of what we it's sending back to us.
Scott, I had a question. So I heard you discussing this on another interview about the surface exposure. Not necessarily, you don't necessarily have to be running around naked outside, that actually it can move through clothing. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Again, I'd say Bob Fosbury has some really great, he's over in England, so he has a cardigan and a sweater and all this other stuff. But he's a great guy. But what he did is he looked at the transmission characteristics through six layers of clothing. And he's got some great pictures where he shows it 850 nanometers. It's come blaring too. It's about 100 times higher than the 650 nanometers. So all these things are wavelength dependent. And, you know, but clothing, you can walk outside in a t-shirt or whatever and be fine. And I think that we also need to really start focusing in on the differences. And I don't mean this bad. There are differences between different people. A woman who's pregnant is doing some amazing things optically where she's blocking the shorter wavelengths, the blues and the UVs, from getting to the fetus. But near infrared is going in, and the amniotic fluid, again, has a peak transmission around 850 nanometers to 900. And it's essentially the womb is acting like a little integrating sphere. And lights bouncing, near infrared lights bouncing around. And then as the pregnancy goes further, the skin stretches and you get more and more wavelengths. And it seems to be tied in with the eye development. And I tell you the story of that because my son, he was talking to a friend of his. She was pregnant and he was telling her all about this. And she's out in Montana. He said, the next day I saw her walking around with her shirt rolled up and her belly exposed. And, you know, it's just, we don't take advantage of the opportunities we have. We've taken sunlight away from our kids. And I think it's a terrible shame in creating all kinds of maladies and anxiety in our children that we shouldn't be causing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. They're sitting in front of the unopposed blue light, non-native blue light, and that's causing an increase in cortisol and a decrease in dopamine, and it's just anxiety and ADD all over the place. I mean, this actually, kids were already being affected by, what was it, those flickering lights back in school. You're getting headaches and migraines. This, since electricity, frankly, it's sort of a perpetual problem, and it continues to get worse. And I think it's so important to address this because I think, you know, piggybacking off what you said about it's about what you're not getting is really important here, and putting that back into people's lives.
Yeah, well, one of the things, though, that I think that people don't, that hasn't been looked into enough is that, you know, we respond on cellular at different time constants. You know, most people think, well, I 24-hour period, I'm going to, you know, go from bright to dark and go to sleep, stay awake, all this. They understand that part of it. But there are other time constants that are going on in the body. And that was one of the paper I did with Russ and Khan and Harlan in biology and in melatonin research. Is that people have to understand that the time constants are, we're talking 10 to 20 minutes, where if you're getting exposed to light or you're doing exercise or you're taking a cold shower, you are altering your hormone levels on a time constant of 10 to 20 minutes. And that is entirely separate from the circadian thing. One of the things we showed in our paper was that I can cause melatonin to go up well above levels at night from the pineal gland simply by doing exercise at 9 a.m. in the morning. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the problems is that so many of the papers don't take into account these time constants and understand that there's a transient response and then there's a long-term response. Mm-hmm. And even you were talking about flickering. You know, if you go down to the cellular level, literally our cells are changing their cell wall potential at a rate of milliseconds. So there's all these different things that we're not considering or taking into account when we're going through these, making these choices. And I think it's all coming back to bite us. As you say, the 60 hertz, 120 hertz type modulation that we're exposed to is a much bigger effect than what we think it does. And we don't understand enough to actually make the judgment call to change from what, because you don't have any of that when you're sitting out in sunlight. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not modulating at 60 hertz or 120 hertz or whatever, 1,000 hertz. It's just sitting there, you know, emitting light, and it changes on a 24-hour period. So I think that there's a lot of more research needs to go into understanding how the non-natural environment we've created, or artificial environment created, is having impact on a wide range of different processes on the biology, on different time scales.
Now, we didn't have to think about it. Our ancient ancestors didn't have to think about the sun. They were like, they worshiped it and they appreciated it and they used it. They didn't have to understand why or how it was working, but they always were in it. Now we have to understand why it matters again to get back out into it.
I mean, one of the things that I did a paper a while back, or tried to publish a paper on, the effect for the cosmetic industry. And, you know, one of the things that you see when you start looking at it optically, you start to see that there is a big difference between different skin types, and that we're one of the few people, I think, that really measured it, is that, you know, it takes 3 to 4 times the amount of near infrared to generate the same level of stimulation if you have dark skin color versus white skin color. And that's not taken into account. You look at most makeup now, they put in SPF to try and, you know, which is, I'm not saying it's terrible, but if they're not taking into account that some people, they don't need SPF, they actually need more light. Mm-hmm. Like someone with very dark skin, a woman with dark skin in higher latitudes, is struggling to generate enough vitamin D. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we need to understand that some people need different things, and it's important, and it puts people at a disadvantage, in my opinion. And it's been kind of one of the focuses of some of the work we've been doing, trying to understand how, you know, we're affecting different parts of the population, not just children not being outside, but children with different needs as far as skin color and age and everything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we talk about the Fitzpatrick scale and different skin tones, and as you noted, the need for higher UV index. And I've actually had a couple of my patients I've instructed or encouraged to relocate, because we're at, I think, what is this, the 46th latitude here in Seattle, Washington. And if I have an African-American woman or man, I'm actually going to mention to them that this isn't the best place for you to live. I actually have one patient who's going to be relocating maybe to Mexico after I had this great talk with her. So it's like, oh man, this doctor is like hardcore. She's telling me my prescription is to move.
Yeah. Well, you know, my frustration, to be quite honest, is that, you know, we're hiding a problem that needs to be dealt with. I mean, one of the worst outcomes from COVID were African-Americans have, one of the data points that bothers me the most is that African-Americans were 40 times more likely to die from COVID than sub-Saharan Africans at the equator. Mm. With basically no vaccination, no, you know, all of the things against them, you know, that's a huge number. That's not a little number. 40 is a big number. Mm-hmm. And, you know, is it because they're in an environment that makes them more susceptible? I believe it is. You know, if I look at the optics of it, you know, they are fighting an uphill battle. Mm-hmm. And especially when we put them in artificial environments that don't have the near infrared component. So,
yeah, the immune system is dependent upon the sunshine. I mean, we're making T cells from UV light. And then you have to consider the mitochondrial haplotype of each person and what their family, where they lived originally and how they perpetuated their family under what light conditions. Was it cold, necessitating consuming animal products and fat and getting cold? Or were they under the heat of the sun and taking in all the photons that way? So there is definitely individual differences, but what is 100% across the board consistent is that every single human being is devoid of this near infrared light on a daily basis.
Yeah. And, you know, when you look at the models of the of children in particular, you know, penetration characteristics or distribution of light in the body, children are smaller. So a higher percentage of their cells are being engaged with the near-infrared component. At least they used to be. You know, when I was growing up, you went outside, you played, got out of school, you went outside, and you played until the streetlight came out.
Mm-hmm.
And when you went home, you were sitting under an incandescent light that was heavy in near-infrared. And then you turn the light off because it costs energy. You know, one of the problems with the whole mantra of the DOE is that what's happening is people are adding light faster than they're saving energy by not, because it doesn't cost them as much to run. So everybody's putting in a light. I've got a neighbor that she's got this blue white light that lights up half the neighborhood, it seems like, and she mm-hmm. won't turn it off at night. You know, it's unfortunate, because I think that if we look at the totality of that, we're really not getting the energy savings we thought we were getting. Number one, number two, it's harmful to not just us, but to insects and to plants and other things. So.
Yeah, can you go into what the benefits on a physical health level of what near infrared is offering? Because we know UVA somewhere around like 9 a.m. in the morning is giving us the pharmaceuticals. I call them pharmaceuticals, right? Your hormones, your neurotransmitters, and then the UVB somewhere around solar noon giving you that vitamin D. What does near infrared light give us that we're missing?
Well, before we do that, could I just... make a kind of a blanket statement about blue.
Oh, yeah.
From the standpoint of everybody has, and I'm not being negative towards blue blockers or all that, but there's no comparison between blue in a sky. When you look outside, like I'm looking out now, it's a beautiful blue sky. Tons of blue photons are coming into my body. But what people don't understand is that blue is a broadband distribution of blue starting from 400 on out to, you know, it's kind of a gentle slope. It's not the same as the narrowband blue that people are getting in artificial lighting or from their TV. But then on top of that, if you were to continue to measure out, and this is one of the fundamental problems, most people only measure visible light. And they say, well, here's blue, you know, here's the sky. Well, if they would continue to measure, and problem being a lot of labs don't have the capability to measure into the near infrared, they'd find that there's this huge tail of near infrared that's associated not just with the sky, but with all the trees and everything around us reflecting near infrared and dirt, reflecting a higher percentage of near infrared into your body. So when people talk about blue, there's blue that's associated with displays and lighting. It's narrow band, it's very high peak intensity, but then there is blue that's the sky, are two entirely different spectra. And I would argue that, you know, it turns out that there's actually a little bit more near infrared to blue ratio in when you're waking up in the morning. Mm-hmm. So the body has always had this benefit of near infrared, even when it's waking up in the morning. And then as you go into the evening, people say, well, you know, it goes to these orange and yellows. Well, that's if you're looking at the sunset. But if you turn around and look at all the rest of the area, it's blue. You know, there's blue everywhere. at night. And we tend to focus on what we, the sunset, rather than thinking about, well, but there's blue coming in from all directions. So I think blue tends to get a bad name, but it's not really because the blue's bad. It's because we didn't provide what nature does, which is the near infrared component that makes up the majority of the, it gives you a added boost or benefit. And, you know, so and then to go back to your question, I just wanted to make that clear.
No, thank you.
But, you know, as far as the, one of the things that always amazed me is that the PBM and the low-level light therapy people, the laser therapy people, there's thousands of papers out there showing different biological effects. And I think what people need to realize is that the body's doing all that simultaneously. So it's like a thousand simultaneous equations going on at one time where glucose is being affected, where, you know, the mitochondrial, the efficiency of the mitochondria is being affected. There's all these different elements that are going on that that are summing up. The body's having to deal with simultaneously. So it's really hard when you look at some of the data from photobio modulation people is they'll see an event. Or they'll see a biomarker that goes up, but is there another biomarker that's going down? You know, we don't, the body's dealing with all of those at once. So it's kind of hard sometimes to take too much of the data from the PBM people, you know, because they tend to focus on one element of health, you know.
I know that the near infrared light is super beneficial for blood flow with the nitric oxide increasing. One could improve the cardiovascular health just being outside receiving the near infrared, or for health's sake, just open your window, because it is not, this light is nonlinear. You can open the window and you can just have it in your home, right?
Yeah, it's unfortunate because, you know, we've done exactly the opposite of what nature does. Nature always guarantees that there's an excess of near infrared for any other, compared to any other wavelength range or portion, whether it be visible or UV. And in, there's even some indications now that some of the, even the longer wavelengths are actually helping us make better or be more efficient at generating vitamin D in the UVA or UVC. Or B, I'm sorry, UVB. So by actually helping photochemically bleach out the outer part of the skin. And that is the thing I just find absolutely fascinating is that we're walking around and the body is essentially trying to optimize the oxidation of cholesterol to make vitamin D. And optically, it's actually changing the absorption characteristics to enhance the amount of 285 that's absorbed, because it's really hard to actually break oxidized cholesterol, and it's not a very efficient process. So, but you know, the body's using other portions of the spectrum. You know, it comes back to this issue that the body's dealing with multiple things. You know, if you you have to take into account that there are multiple, that different wavelengths actually may be working together with other wavelengths to do stuff.
That's right.
And so it's to me, it's just the most amazing thing in the world, how complex the body and the biology is, and how much we've underestimated how important the entire solar spectrum is.
That's right. And so taking that into consideration, where all of these wavelengths are working symbiotically together and sort of like a symphony. Now, what are your thoughts on taking it in parts? If I buy a red light panel or whatever the panels are, the near infrared red light, how is this affecting our environment? We're getting them in parts again. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm an old laser jock from way back when, and in the old days when you had a near infrared laser, you had all kinds of safety and lockout devices, because what happens, my concern is that, you know, we have this real tendency, if a little's good, then a lot's better. And you can't, when you're dealing with a near infrared panel or even a deep red panel, what you're looking at are, on a lot of these cases, are the emitters themselves, which are extremely bright. It's kind of like looking at the sun, only you don't know it's bright because you don't have any eye response in those wavelengths. So one of my concerns is that we are going to start causing some harm because people are going to overexpose themselves in the near infrared because they can't see it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I personally believe that, provide sources that are, give you a visible indication.
Yes.
You know, in our light sources, we generate near infrared and we generate visible in a single source so that you can control the ratio. Because I believe the ratio is the most important part of this whole thing.
Yes.
And that, you know, the body needs a certain amount of near infrared to be exposed to visible and UV. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I don't knock. I mean, people go to them, your whole body, whatever, if it helps, great. But it's not a normal condition that occurs in nature.
That's right.
And in particular, a lot of the LEDs that are being used on PBMs are narrow band. And I would say, how's it any real different than a narrow band blue? I mean, it's causing some process within the body to be accelerated or enhanced, but we don't know whether or not that's good overall. Mm-hmm. So that's my concern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it kind of reminds me of sunblock and just using sunblock, and then you're not receiving the UVB and the UVA to kind of signal like, hey, it's time to get out of the sun because you might get too much near infrared. So it's like you're not getting any signaling when you put sunblock on, for example. Like everything has your body has a built-in system to say the sun gives you the exact parts, right, that you need, right? And so we're trying to pretty much replace the sun and make
I mean, you know, I got in so much trouble when I started saying that, you know, sunblock was actually bad because, and I made that exact argument. I said, you know, you get sunburned to tell you, hey, dummy, it's time to go inside. My grandfather was a dairy farmer. He wore a straw hat and a cotton shirt. And, you know, had enough brains to go sit underneath a shade tree at noon to keep from, you know, getting sunburn, number one. But my problem is that, you know, you start doing some of these things where you're altering what's available, what the sunlight provides, you get yourself into a situation where you're creating an unnatural state. And we don't understand enough about the biology to be so arrogant to think that we can just start whacking up. One of the most terrifying things I heard lately was a guy from Phillips on Technical Lead. And he said, we are now to the point we can identify all these different processes, and we're going to use lasers and we're going to use LEDs to target these particular wavelengths and these processes. And I thought, that's a dumb idea. I mean, that to me is just like, why? You don't know enough to do that. You can't play God that way. So,
yeah, I feel that way about the microbiome. It's like you're with the probiotics and all that. I'm just like, you have no idea what's going on in there. Just leave it alone. I wanted to move into the conversation around blue light specifically, since we're kind of heading and kind of tipping our toes into that. We're realizing that there are melanopsin receptors, not just in the eyes, but all over the body. And so, you know, the melanopsin being blue light detector, non-visual photoreceptors, what do you think the downstream health effects are of using these computers and cell phones that are predominantly blue light, if not blue light totally?
Well, I think the problem, one of the big focuses that I've been trying to understand here lately is that the, you know, blue light and green, well, two things. One, you know, if you look at what happens in the body, in the skin, there are UV generates X amount of free radicals in the skin. you take and look at the visible, it generates the same amount of free radicals. It's just in a slightly different distribution within the skin. So we know that from electron spin resonance data from Zostro and Meinke and others, that, you know, it's not like blue and green aren't doing something to they have just as much power in some ways, or just as much effect on the body as UV does. So people need to get over the idea that it's just UV that's a problem, and that, you know, people are now trying to say, oh, 405 is safe versus, you know, 440 or whatever UV. And it's a continuum in through there. There's a broad range of effects that are going on, especially when you look at just from the free radical standpoint. So, you know, I guess my problem is that the blue is such a, it tends to be a narrow band emitter. It doesn't include the near infrared. I would argue that the near infrared is used by the body to essentially allow us. I mean, we need to be able to see, you know, the difference between that snake is bad, this snake is good, that apple's ripe, this apple. But in order to do that, we are getting exposed to a high level of free radical generation, because those, even the violets and the blues and the cyans, are capable of breaking molecular bonds. So it appears, based on what we've been looking at, is that the near infrared is there to provide all kinds of support to be able to take them. And, you know, like I say, you walk outside in a beautiful blue sky, I can walk around all there for 100 years. You know, I can do that. It's not hurting me. Well, but you have to understand that blue is not just blue. It's also mostly near infrared.
Yeah. And I think that's the problem that we're experiencing these days. And it concerns me with the children being on blue light computers and on their phones. God, I didn't have a phone till I was, I think, 30, but I'm dating myself. But they don't even have a developed myelin sheath yet. And so we know that this is affecting their cognition, their attention, and, you know, could even put them at risk for all sorts of, as we mentioned, Neolithic diseases, cancers, type 2 diabetes, especially when we're considering CLIP and the sugar and the cortisol spikes. What it sounds like to me is that, you know, as opposed to demonizing blue light, including non-native blue light, is like to talk about how can we put the rest back into it.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the point. And, you know, the lighting industry and the display industry, for good reasons, decided that they were going, you know, they can save some energy, they can make it a little bit better, more efficient. But they assign no value to the near-infrared component. And, you know, my goal is that we eventually get to the point that we put a little bit of UV back in. But I don't believe you can do that until you add a significant amount of near-infrared. Because I believe that is what the body has adapted to protect us again, or make it so that we can operate in this environment. And like I say, we operate in this environment for up to 100 years. And, you know, the body's doing just fine. At least it was when we were doing it outside. And unfortunately now, besides the work we're doing with the cancer, is also the neurological effects. I mean, I really believe we are setting our children up for failure. By being so arrogant that we think we can throw away 90% of the solar spectrum and there not be a consequence. So,
Yeah, those, from what I've heard, the incandescent light bulbs are trying to make illegal. Can you tell us a little bit about the incandescent light bulbs? That was the first light bulb we had, and then we can talk about your bulbs. That'd be awesome.
Well, I mean, if you look at, as I said, I'm mostly focused on ratios, because I believe that there's when you're outside underneath a shade tree, it's about three times, from an optical watt standpoint, there's three times the optical watts in the infrared to visible. Visible, you can include the UV in there as well. but that's what happens to nature. With an incandescent bulb, it's actually a 10 to 1, where it's 10 times the near infrared to visible. And you get what they call 10 to 15 lumen per watt efficiencies. When, if you look at an incandescent or at a fluorescent or an LED, the ratio is zero because there's no in the infrared. So we've got this kind of window between 10 to 1 and zero. Mm-hmm. And if you look at, like I say, when you're out underneath a shade tree, it's about 3 to 4 to 1. And that's what we do. We make a hybrid light source where we combine small filament, short filament bulbs with LEDs. And it gives us the broadest distribution available and the closest match to sunlight. And then I tend to use lower, I don't like high peak blue in our lights, so we tend to use a little lower Kelvin temperature. But you get not only the spectral benefits, it actually helps make electro. People were kind of, we kind of were tricked because the eye is easily tricked as to what is light. You know, I can take a red, a green, and a blue, and I can put them together in the right way, and you square up and down, it's white. But it's not spectrally the same as what we get from sunlight. And so we've been trying to broaden the spectrum out, and our goal is to get, you know, we've been able to run it from basically 400 out to about 3,000 nanometers and still give you 3 to 1 near-infrared to visible ratio and give you efficiencies that are on the 40 to 60 lumens or 50 to 60 lumens per watt range, which, you know, in reality is pretty on par to a lot of people that are out there with their LED-only solutions. Mm-hmm. So, and the nice thing about it is the bulb actually, there's electrical benefits as well because we can actually do a dimming. I'm a dark sky advocate, and one of my pet peeves is that when we had incandescent bulbs, we could dim them way down. Very romantic, you know, type of situation. But the LEDs, if you try and dim them, they actually don't dim well. And so we gave up. And so a lot of times, as I say, the neighbor who's got the really bright white light, blue-white light on her porch, she doesn't even have the ability to dim it. So I can't do much. Versus our light bulbs, you can dim them 100,000 to 1 and match. What happens is that as you dim, it actually increases the near-infrared to visible ratio to essentially be mimicking fire, you know, campfire. It's a nice orange glow at the end. So
what do you think of the full spectrum light bulbs? Are they really full spectrum if they don't have the near infrared?
No. As I said, it's so simple to trick the eye. And unfortunately, because we all have great sense of vision, we all think we know, but they're full spectrum is not full spectrum. And all they're doing is adding a little bit of red, a little bit of violet. And what's crazy is that if they try and do it all without, the problem that the DOE has is if they try and do the whole thing with LEDs, you have an efficiency that's less than an incandescent because you have what's called Stokes shift losses and all this other stuff. And you end up with having to put in, you know, tens of different wavelengths to even get close to matching the spectrum that an incandescent bulb, you know, that's why I use little filament bulbs. And what happens is that the reason incandescent, we would all be under incandescent lighting now if it wasn't for the fact that 90% of it is in the near infrared, 10% of it's visible. And if you try and increase that by running it at higher voltage, the filament life goes down dramatically. So what we do is we let the LEDs do what they do well, which is generate visible light. And we use the short filament bulbs to do the near infrared, which it does well because it's almost 100% efficient at generating near infrared. So, and by doing it that way, we are able to drop the filament temperature of the bulb so that the lifetime goes out to where the filament can be as long as the LED's life. So there's really, at this point, there's really no practical benefit to doing LED only. It's just, that's what the government's trying to do. So, and it's kind of frustrating. We are the only, that I know of, we're the only, what they call general service lamp manufacturer in the United States. And the DOE is sitting there trying to basically shut us down because they're talking about having a rule change that would eliminate our ability, making it so that we have to generate 120 lumens per watt. So it's really frustrating because it's like they're making our job so much harder. And like I say, they're shutting down the only lamp manufacturer in the U.S. that I know of. So.
Yeah, they want to dim the sun and artificially light your houses and make us sick. There's no profit in healthy, happy people.
Yeah, well, I'm not quite so.
Oh yeah.
I hope that people are a little bit more than that. But yeah, unfortunately, it's just seems to be what's happening. And
you're so nice. You're so much nicer than me.
Well, it's just a shame because there's an easy solutions, a better solutions, and if they would just get, you know, be a little bit more open-minded, I think that
the cost
associated with illness far outweighs the cost associated with energy production for lighting. And as I say, I mean, I'm a dark sky advocate. You know, we've been going up in nighttime illumination by 10% a year for a decade. You know, the more we make light cheap, the more light people put out. And it's sad.
Yeah.
You know, I remember seeing the Milky Way. So.
Janelle, you had a question.
Oh, no, I was actually just pinging off what you were saying. I think that sometimes that, you know, there's nefarious intentions, but also there's just incompetency. Mm-hmm. And that can be the most, incompetency can be more of a generous assessment sometimes.
Well, I mean, I honestly thought when I started doing this, these optical models and looking at it, I thought, well, this is surely known. And honestly, it's not. And it's really kind of difficult. It's kind of complex when you start looking at how light propagates. In, you know, we've got this, like I say, if you look at the pictures from Bob Fosbury of his hand, you just have to look at it and say, holy cow. You know, he's got a little point source and it's the entire hand is lit up because it's propagating inside the body, you know, inches. And what's really interesting is if you look at the blood vessels, they're what are absorbing. And you think about that just from an evolutionary standpoint, the body is collecting this near infrared. It's distributing, giving everybody a chance to get a little bit of near infrared that stimulates either increased blood flow or whatever. And it's always in proportion. I don't care whether you're talking about direct sunlight or whether you're talking about moonlight.
That's right.
There's a ratio that's always going on. The intensity levels are 9 orders of magnitude. And you think about that. Designing a system that, from an engineering standpoint, a control system that can handle 9 orders of magnitude change in intensity and do that, it's all based on ratios. You know, it's like near infrared to visible ratios, cortisol to melatonin. All these different things are being controlled, you know, using ratios because you can't use absolutes with that kind of dynamic range. So.
Well, I would definitely say that you're a very generous person, your perspective and your innocence. And I get, say no more, dim the sun. And I'm like, what? They know what's up. They know what's up. But yeah, I totally want our listeners to know the name of your company because I think it's important that they have access to this bulb that you can't find anywhere else, near infrared LED combo. What's your company called?
The company is Silas, S-I-L-A-S. And we do, it's under NiraLighting.com. Mm-hmm. And we're a small little company. We're two people, basically. But we are actually, I actually build the lamps in my house at this point in time. But we have gotten UL approval for our lighting, and we're starting to sell them. And I really am trying to sell what they call general service lamps, which is like the Edison bulb, the old A19s and the BR30s and BR40s, because I believe that the underserved, or I guess we need to be able to get this down to the people that mm-hmm. need it the most.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you look at some of these lighting fixtures and things like that, they're expensive. They're, you know, not that we're cheap because we're a small little company trying to get started, but eventually they could be very cheap and inexpensive and available to everybody. Mm-hmm. And that's what I believe needs to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's what we're trying to do. Unfortunately, that's what the DOE is also trying to shut us down on. So it's a difficult situation. But
I hope for the sake of all people interested in healthy lighting that doesn't happen and that you can continue to do the amazing work that you're doing. You know, activism and rebellion looked a lot different in the 50s, 60s, and all of that. The new rebels are going to be going outside in the sun, right? It's like, I'm going outside.
We'll definitely not be televised.
As we talked once before, is that, you know, I think the medical community is really starting to open itself up to the idea that the body is capable of doing a lot of stuff if we just help it a little. Mm-hmm. And, you know, especially you think about it, you know, we've talked about the blue light and all that, but, you know, what is it? One of the things that when I first started doing the models, I could tell you where the photons go. But then the question was, okay, well, what's it doing? And that's when I started doing the work with free radicals. And then if you think about the free radical distribution that you get when you start to look at these, when we're doing exercise, doing stuff, then you start to look at the hormone response. And, you know, I think that there's so much that can be done, especially, you know, when you're going into the hospital, you're already stressed, you're already worrying, you know, that's pumping your cortisol levels up. Is there a way we can provide an environment that maybe suppresses some of the cortisol? Because cortisol, elevated levels of cortisol tends to suppress the immune response. Mm-hmm. You know, how many things, Roger Seeholt did a video here recently on not only on our work, but also he took some patients out, a COVID patient outside, and to give them 30 minutes of sunlight. And, you know, it was a hassle to do it. But when he did it, in that particular case, he saw a marked improvement in how quickly he felt like the person was going to or got out of the hospital. And, you know, we need to let the body do what the body does and understand that the body's doing more than just sitting there like a lump on the log. It's doing so much stuff simultaneously. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And getting our body in the best position to go into surgery or to go, you know, recover from a cold is something that I think that sunlight can play a big role in.
On the matter of antioxidants and cancer prevention and just being well in general, the melatonin that the mitochondria make are stimulated by the near infrared and act as the best antioxidant that we have. And so when we're not out in the light getting the near infrared, we're not making this melatonin, like you said, that is actually made during the day while we're walking, working out, etc. What is your take on supplementing melatonin, if any?
Well, I mean, I did the paper with Russ. Russ is a big advocate for melatonin. I believe that I take it occasionally, but I mainly want to get outside because I believe that one of the things we showed, and I don't think anybody really seems to be getting this, you know, circadian, I'm not arguing about circadian. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but it is secondary to what's really going on in the body. Because once you do make the measurements, and this comes back to the time constants, once you look at measuring And there's only about five papers that I know of that actually do it. Glenn Jeffries and a few others. Once you measure it fast enough during an exercise, and that's the key, during a stressor, melatonin is produced in huge quantities in our muscles, in our skin, you know, by the mitochondria itself. Now, how do we know that? Well, we know that because Theron and others measured melatonin during exercise. And all of a sudden at 9 o'clock in the morning, you see this huge spike in melatonin associated with the exercise, continued and plateaued at 200 picograms per milliliter for 4 hours, stopped the exercise, went back down to baseline. Now that just flies smack in the face of all the circadian stuff, where cortisol is high in the morning, melatonin's low. Melatonin's low, high in the evening, cortisol's low. It's not saying that doesn't happen or that isn't a wish list, but it's not the driver that it's not the predominant place where we're generating melatonin. And melatonin is so unique. I mean, it was picked by the pineal gland because it is an antioxidant. So our brain can function at 80%. During while we're sleeping, when there's no other, very little other cellular activity. So, I mean, I think we need to step back and take a little different look at what the hormones are doing and measure it in real time rather than, okay, I'm going to go lay this person down for a couple hours and then I'm going to and not let them eat, not let them do any exercise. And then I'm going to measure its blood plasma, melatonin levels, and we can get this great curve. But the minute you do something, the minute we are active or get out in the sun or take a cold shower, all those hormone levels are being modulated in ways that we're only now starting to understand. Mm-hmm. So I think that, like I say, I'm not against circadian. It's just not the most important thing in the world to me as far as what's going on, because riding on top of that entire circadian rhythm is life. And it's generating tons of melatonin compared to what we do at night. So
that's right. And for me, it comes back to the mitochondria function. And there's a trend in an interest in mitochondrial support, be it IV NAD, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, just go outside and get the light. That's what the mitochondria need.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Glenn Jeffries has a great paper that's, I think it's published at this point, where he took and put a red light on a small portion, about 10%, less than 10%. That is actually 5%, 800 square centimeters on the back of a person, and exposed them to 15 minutes. And he measured the glucose level in those during, right after, on a time scale of 15 minutes, I think it was. So he could actually see what happens. And what happened was is that with very little energy, and for a short duration, he was actually in on a very limited area of the body, small portion. He was able to see a 27% drop in glucose level in the blood. Mm-hmm. But even more importantly, he actually measured the carbon dioxide level in the blood, and showed that it was also increasing, which clearly points to the mitochondria being affected. Essentially, the red light is enhancing the mitochondria's ability to generate, to do ATP and make it more efficiently. So, I mean, I think it all comes back to this idea that the near infrared and the red are all there for a beneficial effect. And the shorter wavelengths, they're important, we need them, but they come with a toll, and they need the near infrared to essentially do it with the least amount of damage to the body.
Beautiful. Way to summarize all of that. That's incredible. Scott, we're going to definitely be buying some balms from you.
Absolutely.
We'll also put in our show notes the link for your website so that if other people are interested in this better lighting for their lives, we'd love to have you on again to enlighten us, if you will, in the future.
Well, I mean, I learn something every time. It's like you were talking about Sarah. I did a podcast focused on women. And I just think that there's so many areas that we have an opportunity to understand much deeper than what we are and make a big difference. But right now, if I could just get people to get their kids outside, as much as possible, there's such a huge benefit for children. And, that's my thing. And it's up to the parents, unfortunately, to make it happen. And especially in some of the parts of the cities, it's very difficult. I did a paper with Professor John Louis, and he's been trying to get the Black community. He's from Haiti, and he's been trying to get the Black community to understand the effect of sunlight on their body and the fact that, they're not always in the best location to get sunlight and get light that they need.
Yeah, that's right.
And working night shifts and things of that nature. So, I mean, I understand that everybody wants to be sensitive, but at some point we need to get down, put our big boy pants on and have a conversation about how we can, best help everybody, so.
That's right.
Take to the streets like rebels and go outside. Do you remember, we were back in my generation, I guess we're probably all in the same generation here, but we were outside forever. In fact, the news had to remind you had kids. They're like, it's 11 o'clock. Do you know where your kids are? Now you can't get them outside for an hour.
Well, and you look at it, it literally has been the largest, way you think about what rickets did way back when with the pollution, but now we're sitting here and we've taken away, 90% of the solar spectrum, and it was easy to fool everybody because nobody sees it. So and so now we've got all these red light devices and all these things trying to provide a quick fix, and that's. If I have an argument with the PVM people, is let's at least be honest that you want something that happens in 20 to 30 minutes because that's where how you can make money. You know, if it takes 2 hours or 3 hours or 4 hours, it's not a good treatment. That doesn't work out financially very well, versus that's not what nature intended. Nature intended for you to get a proportion of the two. You're always in proportion. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter whether you're in direct sunlight or whether you're looking at the moonlight or whether you're, walking in the woods. It's always trying to force you to have more near infrared than visible and UV. Mm-hmm. So,
yep. And different parts of the day have different ratios of each one. And it's a beautiful symphony. So
I like symphony. I think symphony is a really good way of describing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And unfortunately, somebody's out of tune and not playing well.
Shut your computer.
Yeah. But, and to be honest, what we do is our lights, they provide 5 optical watts of near infrared in each bulb and then 1.5 to 2 optical watts of visible. So we maintain that 3-to-1 ratio. And, is it perfect? No, it's not perfect, but it's the closest match we can come up with. And it has other benefits as well. So, and we offer a DC version and an AC. The AC has a slight amount of flicker in it, but we've dropped it down to what we think is about the best level. Mm-hmm. If I can convince people to buy the lamp, that's what I do because it's a DC. There's zero flicker in it. It's just a little desk lamp and it converts from the AC wall to DC. So it has, zero flicker. And there's a, Glenn's done a really great test here lately where he literally took two women who were down in a an area that had just LED down windows, had LED lighting only. And he put in an incandescent bulb next to where they were. Didn't turn off the LEDs, just put the incandescent in. And he was able to show that their eyesight actually improved in 1 to 2 weeks.
Oh, so, wow. Mm-hmm.
They're, it's starting to happen. People are starting to get looking at it at a time scale and in a way that you can see that there's a positive benefit to the near infrared, and we need to put it back.
Yes, we do. Yeah. Give us back our near infrared.
Okay, when are you going to have the posters out and you're going to be marching on City Hall?
That's right. Well, you know,
as Roger says, you know, it's for free if you just go outside. So
yeah. Open the window, go outside. It's free. Yeah, I mean, and look at, I mean, you, there's a really high bar set by the sun. So hey, I applaud you.
Like, take a crack at it.
Yeah. Well, we do a pretty good match, but I just wish that you first have to get people to accept the fact that there's something there that they need to deal with.
Yeah, that's
you
right.
know, until you do that, you know, the industry is going to keep on doing what it's doing. And you know, to me, it's crazy that women are so much of all our customers. Women are the ones that really seem to be most in tune with it. And I, you know, you have such a huge improved sense of color. You can see color better than men can. And so there's all these things that are clearly indicating that, you know, tell the husband to shut up, sit down, and get a ball. But
they don't notice anything. It's like, I got my hair colored. Oh, okay. Didn't notice.
Well, it's like trying to have an argument over what paint color. I mean, I learned long ago. My wife knows paint better than I do, by far. I think she sees like 13 shades and I see two. So, you know, we are all unique, and we need to take advantage of that uniqueness as best we can. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's very important, because I think that you start looking at the anxiety levels and the stress levels, especially with cortisol effects and melatonin suppression. You know, I think that there's a real opportunity to, you know, let people be optimal, you put them in the best environment that we can. And it doesn't have to cost us a bunch of money. It doesn't have to, you know, it's just more of a learning curve, I guess, or acceptance that it's important.
Yeah, just exposing people to the information is what we're here to do. So. Yeah. Thank you so much again for helping us to expose this information. People don't know about these things, and the light of our lives is so critical. So, Scott, thank you so much.
Yeah, bless you, Scott, for your work and for sharing today.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Okay, thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
We hope this conversation has empowered you. Remember, you are unique. And you are a miracle. Your body doesn't make mistakes. It responds perfectly to an imperfect environment. Until next time, go get that life.